All right, I think we're ready to start here, and today we're in lesson 19 of The Fear of God, and we're still in chapter 6, last chapter. We have, this is the fourth section in that chapter. We're covering the motives that we have to fear God. There are two smaller sections left, how to grow in the fear of God and hindrances to fearing God. And in looking at the schedule for the rest of the month, what is today, the 10th or so? Something like that? Today is the 11th. So I don't know if we can finish in two more weeks, and then we'd have the first Sunday of the month we wouldn't be meeting, and then I think the second Sunday in February is the 8th. So I think we can get through the material here in two Sundays, but I wanted to have one additional Sunday to go over, cover the main points of the book, takeaways, both from my perspective and from your all's. So unless we finish a great deal of material next week, then I think we've got a plan on February 8th being the last class. But if we can finish by the end of the month, I'm going to aim for that. So I don't think that's terribly ambitious. The amount of newer material in the book at this stage is diminishing, so we're not going to be faced with lots of new concepts as we finish this last chapter. So does that sound reasonable to you guys, try to finish in that time frame? Okay. All right, so we're in motives to fear God, and the motives we covered last week were, number one, let's God's distinguishing love for you be a motive to fear Him greatly. We looked at the benefits that come only through conversion and are only given to God's people. There are a number of privileges that it puts us under. There were a dozen or so listed last week. We've covered those in their own section, each of those privileges, but He reminds us that this is a good motive. And the man who grows in this grace of the fear of the Lord will escape those evils into which others will fall. And number four, to grow in this grace of the fear of God is the way to be kept always in a conscientious performance of Christian duties. So this is a helpful reminder. And we'll look at quite a few additional motives today. And I don't anticipate moving into the how to grow and hindrances sections, but to focus just on the remaining 10 items or so in this list. So number five, living by fear is wise. This is should seem pretty self-evident at this stage, but it's an important reminder nonetheless that a wise man is someone who considers his ways, considers the world around him, and acts accordingly. A wise man fears and departs from evil, but a fool rages and is self-confident. One of the references he finds in Proverbs 14. So is it not a high point of wisdom for a man to be always doing that which confirms him to the conduct of angels? So it's interesting rhetoric here, and I think what Bunyan sees is the fact that fear and a life of fear puts us in the path of holiness. And in this case, you can see that the man who is properly fearful, he departs from evil. And this is a grace that is to be pursued. It's a grace to be absorbed into our life and perfected. And for Bunyan, when he sees the idea of this being a high point or a pinnacle, he sees that this is the way heaven is orchestrated. This is the governing thought is to be in awe of God and to appreciate His majesty and His grandeur. So the conclusion he draws from that is, doesn't it then make sense for each of you to pursue that characteristic and that perspective that you will have while you're in heaven, you have after this life? So I think it does make a lot of sense. I think it is something that should motivate us, that perfection in heaven will have a strong resemblance to a fearful life on earth. And it's something that is not practiced because it helps us in this way or helps us in this way. It's sort of a crowning grace. It's a crowning perspective that we will have in the life to come. But there are other references as well. The fear of the Lord in Proverbs 1:7 is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and instruction. Proverbs 2:5, then you will understand the fear of the Lord and find the knowledge of God. In Proverbs 3:7, do not be wise in your own eyes, but for fear of the Lord and depart from evil. There are other verses. We've looked at Proverbs 9:10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is understanding. We've looked at a fair number of these verses over the weeks. And I'm struck with the plain teaching of Proverbs on this particular characteristic and how valuable it is. Solomon makes it abundantly clear when you read Proverbs, especially the opening as he sets the framework for what's to be discussed in the book, that here the fear of the Lord is the very beginning of knowledge, but it's the fool who's going to despise wisdom and instruction. So there are a lot of smart people out there, and when you read the book of Proverbs, it's not a book designed to make you better in calculus or chemistry or deconstructing poetry. You're not necessarily going to be skilled in those areas. But there are some really important patterns to put into your life that begin in the opening of Proverbs. And this idea of the fear of God giving you the lens with which you then go out and dissect wisdom and gain understanding is critical in my mind to what Solomon is trying to set for us. So one of the challenges I was thinking about in rereading Proverbs with fresh eyes, because I'm sure many of you have read Proverbs for many years. We've read it quite a bit in our house. I went through a time in my life where I read a chapter in Proverbs every day, covered the book every month, and you go through the material and you go through the material and learn it, and it's all very helpful. But the challenge is, let's take a fresh set of eyes in the book of Proverbs and think about this idea of fear when you read it, that this is that God wants me to adopt a certain posture when I'm approaching Him looking for wisdom and looking for instruction, looking for understanding, when I'm looking for escape from my temptations, right? So you want to depart from evil, you need to understand and be able to embrace the fear of God. So when you're reading the book of Proverbs, read it with a fresh set of eyes, and when you encounter these many different passages, the ones I've listed here are not all of them, but when you encounter them, stop and think. This section right here is telling me I need to fear God in order to gain this particular characteristic. Now, what does that mean? How do I go about doing it? So it's not easy, and the words are familiar to us, which makes it pretty convenient to read right through the book. But I think what Solomon wants, what Bunyan is emphasizing, is that if you want to grow in the grace of the fear of God, one of the motives is to see the promises embedded within it, and we find the promise of gaining wisdom and learning how to order your life in a wise way to be prominent, and it's especially prominent in the book of Proverbs. All right, so let's go to number 6 here. It is seemly for saints to fear and increase in the fear of God. So Bunyan sees this idea that God being your creator has a certain authority to it, that simply by virtue of the fact that He is your creator, he can put a charge upon you to act a certain way. You don't get to act the way you want to act. You're required to act the way God wants you to act. So this is not a difficult idea, but it is a motive for us. We are created by God, and we are to live a certain way. And one of the ways he describes is the fact that we would stand before him in fear. So we should fear God as a motive. We should fear God simply because he made us, and we are his. And he is not like us. So number 7, I thought, is probably requires a little bit of explanation, because I think it has a broader picture to it than maybe what the description tells us. And number 7 reads, "It's honorable to grow in the grace of fear." He looks at Hosea 13 verse 1 when Ephraim spoke trembling. He exalted himself in Israel. I don't know that verse, as it stands alone, is altogether helpful in helping us see, you know, what to put into practice here, what to do. But obviously, God sees something great in the conduct here. But the quote Bunyan has in this section that struck me as interesting is that when I greatly fear my God, I am above the fear of all others, nor can anything in this world be it ever, I think it's supposed to be ever, so terrible and dreadful, move me at all to fear them. So what is he getting at here in this passage? Well, in part, it's when Ephraim was conducting himself in a holy way, in a trembling way, that he was exalted, and that's how he was looked at. He was seen not as someone who is base, but someone who is conducting himself in a righteous way. And Bunyan sees this honorableness as a liberating attribute in our life. So growing in the fear of God is honorable, but part of what makes it honorable is what it allows us to do. It liberates us to follow God exclusively and not be beholden to the pulls and the tugs of society and religion around us. And I think maybe one way to help us understand why this is an important motivation, even though the description that Hosea referenced may not communicate as much as we'd like for it to. But imagine for a moment conducting yourself in such a way so that from here on out you would be completely free from the fear of men. That every part of your life would be free from the fear of men. You'd be free from their reactions and their reprisals. You'd be free from their approval. To not need their approval. And I think Jesus addresses this idea straight on, especially as it relates to how we conduct our life when we look at Luke 12 verses 4 and 5. "And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid of those who kill the body and after that have no more they can do to you. But I will show you whom you should fear. Fear him who, after he has killed, has the power to cast into hell. Yes, I say to you, fear him." Now, one of the things Jesus is urging in this passage is the freedom to serve God completely and without reservation. Now, when I say that the fear of God elevates you above the fear of man, I don't want you to think that absolves you from, say, showing respect to certain individuals who have a dignity in an office that's worthy of respect. You say, "Well, I fear God, so I don't need to pay homage to anyone because I pay homage only to God." That's not the point we're making here. There are people who are well deserved in being spoken of highly around us. But if our lives are governed by what we think will be the result of the interaction between those individuals and ourselves, and we're conducting ourselves in fear of them, that we're moving from one situation to the next, where the fear of people around you, their approval, what are people going to think if I do this? What Bunyan's getting at is this is a debilitating fear, and it doesn't free you to serve God. Now, does that mean it matters not how you dress or what color you paint your house or something like that? Well, I'm sure those things have a proper role. You know, if you paint your house in such a way or you decorate your house in such a way so that it drops the value of property all around just because you've got some notion in your head that this is be a really cool way to live. You know, that might not be respecting your neighbors and their property value. You might need to take stock of your motives and what it does to your neighbor. But what about simple ideas and sharing the gospel and telling people you're a Christian or that you're Reformed Presbyterian or saying that you decide to homeschool or you want to defend the actions of your family worship or the way you raise your kids? You know, there are a lot of subtle pressures that come to us from a lot of different places in life. And my experience is that those pressures never really push us to act in accord with our heartfelt convictions. And if anything, they want us to stop. You know, the world is at enmity against God, and that includes a lot of areas of our life. But walking in the fear of God means that you're taking a different perspective on the interaction that you have with others around you. And you are being liberated to do what is right. Now, again, this is not the sort of topic that subject matter that covers what color you're painting your house. That's not the point. The point's not to be, I fear God so I can be a jerk, right? I mean, that's hardly what we're advocating. But instead, I think where most of us tend to find a struggle is being free to pursue the Christian life in all of its implications, to share the gospel, to freely worship, to interact with each other, to raise our children, to educate our children, to encourage other people who are educating their children in the face of folks who don't see it that way. And if you're one of those individuals making compromises because you're afraid of what people are going to say or you imagine what they're going to say or what they're going to think about what you're doing, well then, you're elevating the fear of man far above the fear of God in your life. And if you think you have sound basis for God telling you to act a certain way, which I think he does tell you to act in a certain way, that it's perfectly appropriate to walk out of a movie, for instance, if it's in such poor taste or it's blasphemous, or to walk out of a concert, or you know, to leave a production of some sort, and people may think ill of you for those things. I think what Jesus is telling us in Luke 12, you know, the worst that's going to happen to you is that one of the people that you've offended is going to kill your body. That's the worst that can happen. That is the worst. The worst thing that can happen to you that they can do to you. But that's not the worst thing that can happen to you from anyone. Because after your body is dead, you have a soul which lives forever and must give an account. And do you want Jesus to say, I never knew you? He's ashamed of you because you wouldn't own up to his name and his ways. Is that how you want to conduct your life? Or do you want to conduct your life saying, yes, you know, the repercussions of what I'm saying and what I'm doing are such that people are going to be upset with me, and it has financial implications to it, or it has other implications to it. I realize that. And I'm willing to take those consequences, because what I really fear is not what you're going to do to me, or what you're going to say, or what you're going to think about me. But I'm willing to do these things because I'm really far more worried about what God's going to think of me. So this idea of being liberated from the fear of men around you so that you can be free to serve God with a whole heart is really critical. It doesn't mean that fearing God will put you in a position where unpleasant things won't happen to you. I am not saying that. unpleasant things may very well happen to you. That also is the way of the godly. But it's not the worst thing that could happen to you. And there's a big difference between something unpleasant happening and the worst thing happening. The worst they can do is not the worst that can happen to you. So there's this passage in Isaiah in chapter 8 here. There's a similar thought being expressed when God's delivering this prophecy. And in an earlier verse, he says, "For the Lord spoke thus to me with a strong hand and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of this people." So God's telling Isaiah, do not walk in the way that these people are walking. And so he's insistent that his people especially, but certainly Isaiah and the remnant, would not walk in the way of their neighbors. And he tells them, do not say a conspiracy concerning all that these people call a conspiracy, nor be afraid of their threats, nor be troubled. The Lord of hosts, him you shall hallow. Let him be your fear, and let him be your dread. So here there was an enticement to walk in the way of the wicked in the surrounding nations, and even within the people of God themselves who were committing terrible apostasy. And the comfort that God gives is not that I'll keep you safe. It's not that no trouble will come upon you. The comfort that he says is, don't fear them. Let me be your dread. Don't let those around you who are governing the social mores be the ones who are dictating your fear. Don't be afraid of their threats, and don't be troubled by them. The Lord of hosts, him you shall hallow. Let him be your fear. Let him be your dread. So in my mind then, the takeaway for this section is that if you make God the object of your fear, your temporal fears tend to dissipate. They tend to be seen in a new light and are not as threatening as they once were. All right, so number 8, this fear and the increase of its fear qualifies a man to be entrusted with heavenly and spiritual things, yes, and with earthly things as well. This is an interesting passage. Bunyan divides this section into two areas, and the first comes from Malachi 2, where God, in a rebuke to his people, describes the glorious benefit the priests were given as teachers of God's covenant. He said, "Then you shall know that I have sent this commandment to you, that my covenant with Levi may continue, says the Lord of hosts. My covenant was with him, one of life and peace, and I gave them to him that he might fear me. So he feared me and was reverent before my name. The law of truth was in his mouth, and injustice was not found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity, turning many away from iniquity." So this idea that people were entrusted with spiritual things, with the truth of the scriptures, so that they might communicate them to others, should motivate us, given what we see happen. The law of truth was in his mouth, justice not found on his lips. He walked with me in peace and equity and turned many away from iniquity. So having a motive to fear God is not simply an encouragement to memorize the Bible, but it's to walk before God in a holy way, illustrating the truth of the scriptures, so that those in our life that we have some influence over, be it our spouses, be it our kids, be it our friends, people around us here in the congregation, social gatherings, whatever, might also benefit from it and be turned away from their iniquity, to be known as somebody who deals in peace and in equity. So there's a real benefit here, and it should motivate us that if these are things we desire, the way to accomplish those tasks is to abound in the fear of the Lord. Now, Bunyan makes two points about this motive, is that this motive this item should motivate us so that we see both its spiritual implications and its physical implications as well. And I'm not going to go through all the references and the ideas he had behind it. I think we can summarize it instead. But when you think of people fearing God and then God entrusting them to earthly or physical or of this world type components. I wonder what comes to mind. For some individuals, prosperity comes to mind. You know, that God will grant you individually increase. And I've heard that kind of teaching through the years, that God's way of blessing is materially in this sense. But what Bunyan points out, and I think he does a good job of citing for us examples of, say, Joseph over his brothers in the land of Egypt. Joseph was somebody who feared God, right? We see that evident in the way he conducted himself with Potiphar's wife, and yet he came to be esteemed over the whole land. Obadiah, we looked at Obadiah a number of weeks ago, who was some sort of steward, who was over Ahab's house, who harbored and gave safe passage to the prophets. We find Daniel and all of his friends there in the land of Babylon, that they were ones who clearly exhibited a fear of God, and God exalted them in this earthly world to accomplish his will. The last example given was that of Mordecai with Esther, and to see the interaction with the influence on the slaughter that was about to come to the Jews. So, you know, there's a point here. It's I don't want you to walk away with the point that if I learn the fear of God, God's going to do something great with me. You know, I have no idea what God's going to do with you. He may use you as an example in many other ways. But if God needs something important done in this world, and he wants to use his people to do it, the ones he tends to focus on are those who fear his name. Those are the ones that God tends to use to accomplish his purposes. So if it's something out of the ordinary that he's going to accomplish, and it involves the interaction with this world in a rather significant way, it does seem that there is a pattern here of God choosing people who have demonstrated fear to him. Now, I couldn't help but think that of all the examples cited, personal enrichment wasn't the end in mind by any of the individuals. I'm not saying these are the only individuals we should look at. There are others. You guys may have some other examples. But God was using these people, and throughout this list, he was using these people to influence the state, to bring about the purpose of nourishing the kingdom. So, you know, personal enrichment doesn't seem to be the end goal in mind, but it's changing the nations of the world so that they would countenance the church in some positive way. It's interesting. You'd almost think Bunyan was on the verge of being a covenanter by his thoughts on the importance of the influence of the fear of God over the state. It's certainly something we need today. I don't know how that would ever look. I don't know how a person would go about becoming involved in, actually, for all these people, maybe with the exception of Obadiah, they were kidnapped. They were abducted in some capacity. So I'm not sure how you implement this, except that if God does need something done, apparently he looks to those who fear him. And the realm of the state is not outside the realm of places where he intends to accomplish his work. All right, let's move on to number 9, where the fear of God is in the heart of any is not growing. No grace thrives, nor is duty done as it should be. I think Bunyan might be mistaken for a pediatrician or maybe a vet, because he's got this haunting language in here. At least it's something that made me harken back to a fear that mothers and ranchers have, a failure to thrive. Yeah, and if you're a vet, you might say ill thrift, which I thought was an interesting description. Failure to thrive or ill thrift is the meaning that Bunyan has behind his 9th point here as a motive for us. 2 Corinthians 7:1 reads, "Therefore, having these promises, beloved, let us cleanse ourselves from all filthiness of the flesh and spirit, perfecting holiness in the fear of God." So it's clear that from within this section and others throughout the book, that Bunyan sees the fear of God as something that can be improved upon. And that in general, grace is something that can be improved upon in your life. So this has some real implications. It means the stock of grace available is not limited, right? The stock of grace available to any one of our lives is not fixed in quantity, so that to have more is outside our reach. We're unable to attain it. So Paul has a serious exhortation here of that the active verb here is perfecting. He wants us to perfect holiness in the fear of God. And if that was something that were outside our grasp, then I doubt he would state it that way. He might say, be content with your holiness. Think of the fear of God or some such thing. But he's directing us to perfect this grace. That seems to be something that requires our action and effort, doesn't it? That God's telling us, this is something you need to do. You need to perfect this grace that's put within you. So Paul, in another section over in Philippians, he writes, "I thank my God upon every remembrance of you, always in every prayer of mine, making request for you all with joy, for your fellowship in the gospel from this very day until now, being confident to this very thing, that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ." Philippians 1:3 there. Well, when Paul instructs us to perfect holiness, he has the same idea in mind that he also wrote to the Philippians when he says that he who has begun a good work in you will complete it until the day of Jesus Christ. It's the same word used in both places. In Corinthians, he's saying, you need to perfect holiness in the fear of God. And in Philippians, he's saying, I'm confident that God is going to perfect this work in you. He is going to bring about this completed end. So, what does this mean? Is God the one who's perfecting the work in us? Or are we the one who are actively perfecting the work within us? Because they're really saying two different things, aren't they? It's the same word and same idea. It means to bring about its end in mind, to complete something, to bring it to fruition is the goal in mind. And yet, we see that Paul's saying, God's begun this work and he will complete it. He's confident to this. And yet in Corinthians, he's saying, perfect holiness in the fear of God. So, it seems to me that we have a old-fashioned conundrum on our hands. Which is it? How do we understand? I don't want to use the word reconcile, but how do we understand the dual use of the same word, which I think they're getting at the same point in both cases? How would you think about this? What does it mean for God to begin to complete something he began in you, and then for you to perfect something? How should we think about that?
Our responsibility for participating in the means of grace.
Yeah, I think we do have a responsibility to participate in the means of grace. Yeah. Sam?
God uses means, and those means could be the works that he's set apart for us to do through his grace to sanctify us.
Yeah, that's right. He uses his means. I think you could even more broadly extend that to say he uses providence, doesn't he, to pursue these things. I mean, that's one of the purposes of God ordering creation the way he does, is to help us grow, right? And you know, we encounter situations that are adverse to our character. Well, the answer is not to avoid those situations. The answer is to change your character. So it is the means of grace that he's prescribed for us singing, praying, reading the Word, listening to sermons, being in class, fellowship. These are all things that are important, but there are also means, one of which is families, dads, elders, pastor. There are lots of people that are used to sanctify you. Police, right? There are lots of different ways to be sanctified. And when God puts you in these situations, which He intends to do quite regularly, when you look at the state of your family, or the state of the government, or your employment, or whatever the circle is that you're considering at that time, the adversity you're following may be there. It may exist solely, not to cause you discomfort, but to help you understand what needs to change in your life, that you need to perfect holiness in the fear of God. And you should rest knowing that God is completing this work in you by bringing about the circumstances in your life to bring you to repentance and to faith and transformation. The way God has ordered the world is not random. And His chief concern is not your comfort, but your character. He wants you to be conformed to the image of the Lord Jesus Christ. And in so doing, He will be perfecting holiness in you. And I'm confident that what he has begun, he will continue until the day you die. All right, we're on to number 10 here. The grace of fear is a grace that, if you abound therein, will give you great boldness with God and man. And he has this section from Nehemiah here we'll read in just a minute, but he offers a couple of examples. One was that of Job, and this required me to rethink a bit what I had previously considered about Job, that often when Job was accused of his friends, that by his colleagues there, Bunyan says, he repelled them with the testimony of a good conscience. So how do we know Job had a good conscience? Well, he tells us at the opening of the book how he conducted his life in the fear of God, right? He got up and he offered sacrifices and prayed for his children, and he was righteous and walked in the sight of God. And it made me think that if you guys were needing boldness, would you rely on your clean conscience to propel you to whatever was being requested of you or required of you? You know, it's easy to read the book of Job and to see the error of all of his friends and to see Job's error in not understanding the end game God had in mind, right? Job was protesting with his righteousness, and in fact, I think protesting too much, but he's protesting based on his clean conscience. And, you know, we see the error of all the players because we get the end of the story, right? But it's downright remarkable that someone would want to contend with God and His providential dealings in their life by protesting his clean conscience. Right? Would that really be your defense? Look at my life. Look at how I live my life. I know I'm not guilty. I know I'm free from what it is that's the blame that's coming my way. Job did. Job was not articulating that he was perfect. He wasn't advocating that, but he said, I've done nothing to deserve this. My hands are clean. It reminds me of the accusations that when Jesus was being accused of sinful behavior. And he said, who of you convicts me of sin? Any sin. Which of you does these things? Well, that takes an enormous boldness or stupidity, right? I mean, somebody is insensible of their condition and insensible of their sinfulness. And we certainly all have a degree of that. But this idea that you would hearken back to your clean conscience as vindication to argue with your friends about the distress in your life and argue with God about the distress in your life strikes me as something pretty important, that Job's fear really did keep him from evil in many ways. Now, I wasn't there, you weren't there, there are a lot of details we don't know, so we don't want to press this point too difficult, but I don't think we have to press it very hard to realize that there are very few of us who would want to protest our innocence based on our conduct in mind and in deed. Right? Well, the fear of God is what you need to propel you into the conduct that enables you to do those things. So, look at this passage in Nehemiah. He said, O Lord, I pray, please let your ear be attentive to the prayer of your servant and to the prayer of your servants who desire to fear your name, and let your servant prosper this day, I pray, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's, Artaxerxes' cupbearer. So this is building up to the point where Nehemiah is going to ask permission to leave the court and lead God's people back to the promised land, back to Israel, so that they could begin the rebuilding according to the prophecies that had been made earlier. Excuse me. And I'm sure the being the king's cupbearer was not something that you took lightly. You didn't just walk off the job. And yet Nehemiah here is seeking to grow in his fear so that he can be bold to ask a king who might just have you killed, that he could go do this thing that God's called him to do. 11, by the fear of the Lord and by growing in this fear, you may have your labors blessed to the saving of souls. Bunyan, I certainly had the impression reading this that Bunyan believes that the fear of God helps in evangelism. We see this passage in 1 Peter 3 specifically directed to wives, but I think it's more broadly applicable. Wives, likewise, be submissive to your own husbands, that even if some do not obey the word, they, without a word, may be won by the conduct of the wives when they observe your chaste conduct accompanied by fear. So without the fear of God, our profession tends to fall flat and evangelism ends up being an empty endeavor. He says, Bunyan says, alas, the world will not be convinced by your talk and by your ideas and by the great profession that you make. They see not therewith mixed with the lively impressions of the fear of God. So Bunyan thinks this idea of your profession, the things that you're telling people, should be mixed with the fear of God. And from the perspective of the people you're witnessing to, they see these lively impressions. That's how he describes the way the fear of God should be affecting your life in a visible way. I don't mean you shake or tremble, but they see your conduct. They see what your... Everybody else talks this way, you're talking this way. People are doing these things, you are not doing these things. You are doing these things over here when other people are not. So Bunyan's saying you need more than just your words, and he looks at this passage in 1 Peter as one example of that. Alright, number 12, the fear of God is the way to engage God to deliver you from many outward dangers into which you may fall. In Exodus here, we're running out of time, I'm not going to read, I'm sure it's a familiar passage. The king of Egypt spoke to the Hebrew midwives, and you remember what he told them. Kill all the males, right? We don't want any of these males alive. And the Hebrew, or the midwives, they were terrified. Not of the king's decree so much, I'm sure they were frightened of that, but they were terrified of God. And it was his fear, specifically mentioned, that enabled them to be freed and delivered from the trouble that and the harm that was meant for them. I'd encourage you to read that entire chapter. It's a wonderful chapter in what takes place, but it's also an example of what we decide, or what we read in a Luke passage when Jesus tells us to fear God and don't fear those who can only kill you. Really, this is an application of what Jesus is saying. They were called to do something that was inherently wrong, and they refused to do it. So, we'll finish up here very quickly. 13th motivation is this is the way to be delivered from errors and damnable opinions. Comes from Ecclesiastes 7, verses 15 and 18. I've seen everything in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs life in his wickedness. Do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp this, and also not remove your hand from the other. For he who fears God will escape them all. Walking in the fear of the Lord will keep you from walking around with shoes that are way too tight, being overly righteous and overly wise about things that you probably shouldn't be. Number 14, another motive to fear and to grow in this fear of God is those who fear God have leave, be they never so dark in their souls, to come boldly to Jesus Christ and to trust in Him for life. So Isaiah 50:10 is a passage he quotes. Who among you fears the Lord? Who obeys the voice of His servant? Who walks in darkness and has no light? Let him trust in the name of the Lord and rely upon His God. The point being here that God always wants you to call on Him. And having the right fear, having this apprehension of God in the right light, even when you're feeling like you're in a dark place, that there is no grace in your life, you feel alienated and far away, there is still provision for you to have permission to come to God. You are never so far from God that you are unable or unlicensed to call upon Him in the day of your trouble. All right, 15, God will own and acknowledge such to be His, whoever He rejects. Yea, He will distinguish and separate them from all others in the day of His terrible judgments. Ezekiel 9 is the account that Bunyan has in mind. I had forgotten about this passage, but this is a passage in a vision given to the prophet where some men appear, and God commands one of the men to take an inkhorn and make a mark upon people who do not sigh after the abominations of Israel. And then he sends other men out, and he says, slaughter everyone. And Ezekiel says, wait a minute, why? How could you possibly treat people this way? You can't. You're going to destroy the remnant of Israel. And God is very clear, don't destroy anybody that's got the mark on them from this man that went out with the inkhorn. The man in the inkhorn comes back, says, I've done what you told me to do, and judgment begins. It's a helpful passage to be reminded that God sees all things. He knows what's in our heart. He knows what we secretly lust after. He knows how to mark those who are His own. And Bunyan closes with this passage from his Malachi 3, which I think is also helpful, to be reminded of that we are not our own. Then those who feared the Lord spoke to one another, and the Lord listened and heard them. So a book of remembrance was written before Him for those who fear the Lord and who meditate on His name. They shall be mine, says the Lord of hosts, on the day that I make them my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spares his own son who serves him. There is a book with your name written in it. There is. God knows who you are. He has written and recorded your name indelibly in heaven. The final judgment will not come for you, but will come for others. Therefore, it's incumbent upon everyone to walk in the fear of the Lord, to call upon Him, to teach their sons and their daughters, to teach their spouse and their family, their neighbors, to walk in the light of God's fear, so that they too can have their names written in the Lamb's Book of Life. So, you can demonstrate that your name's in this book by speaking to those around you about God's fear, about Him, and meditating on His name. This is evidence that your name is written in the Book of Life. You don't need to see the book. The book is in heaven, safely, and we are on the earth. We demonstrate it a different way. So this should be another motive for us to fear the Lord. Now, those are the end of his motives. We'll move into the section on how to grow in the fear of God, and the concluding section, how to overcome the hindrances that we face in the fear of God.